This is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine. Homeopathy. Secret Society. Hypnosis. The Paranormal. Alternative Energy. UFO. Abduction. The Weird. The Wild. And the Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? We had quite the adventure this week. We went up to the Indian lands. That was nice.
Yes, it was.
We talked to Kevin Annette, who came out with that film Unrepentant about 4 years ago. We were in Brantford, Ontario, Canada. We drove up there, sat down with him, and had a live interview. Just so the listeners know, if that's why the audio is choppy, is we had to do the video recording, which will be up on YouTube.
Yep.
That'll be good. Tom, could you read his bio, please?
Certainly could. Well, Kevin, as you said, was a former United Church minister who reveals Canada's darkest secret, which was the deliberate extermination of indigenous Native American peoples and the theft of their land under the guise of religion. In this never-before-told history, as seen through the eyes of this former minister, who blew the whistle on his own church after he learned of the thousands of murders in its Indian residential schools. His book, The Hidden No Longer, Genocide in Canada, Past and Present, and the video, as we mentioned, Unrepentant on Google Video, has caused incredible waves through the political and religious circles.
Without further ado, here's the audio of that interview we did with Kevin Annette. Enjoy. Hello, we're talking to Kevin Annette, who did the film Unrepentant. Kevin Annette, the Canadian genocide. And he'll be telling us about what he's done. Now, that movie was about 4 years ago.
That's right, 2007, around January, released it.
Okay. I'm curious to know, well, first of all, what we always usually cover is the history. So what, in a bullet point, what got you to that point of making a documentary? Because I'm sure there's a lot to it.
Well, the reason the documentary was made was because there was a need at the time to tell my story, because really I had been the only one since 1996 documenting these crimes in the residential schools. And that same year, the government apologized for the first time for these crimes, and it was talked about in Parliament. But the reason it was apologized for was because of all the work we'd been doing publicly. So we felt there was a need to tell the history that had led to that, and also to show the story from the point of view of an establishment white guy, because most white people aren't going to relate to the story if it's just about Indians. That's kind of the hard reality. So we were trying to reach more of the mainstream with a film that was kind of the philosophy behind it.
Okay. What have been the ramifications of making the documentary?
Well, in a nutshell, we forced the issue onto the stage in Canada. An example of that is the member of Parliament who stood up for the first time and asked the question, when are these children going to be brought home for proper burial? Gary Morasty, he had watched our film. He was a native MP from Saskatchewan. And all of his constituents were saying, you better do something about this. You know, there's graves all over the country. So he stood up, and after that, within a few weeks of him asking that question in Parliament, they had announced their so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The apology was formulated. And, you know, they even talked about forming a missing children's task force, although that never happened.
No.
But it shows you, you know, the power of just getting this out. We didn't do it in a professional manner. We just did the basic facts and stuck it up on our internet and on Google.
Yeah.
And within a year, there were 500,000 hits. So,
right.
You know.
Definitely a pretty impactful film. I seen it about 4 years ago when it first came up. And amazing film. Absolutely amazing. But just for those people who have not seen the film and are wondering what we're talking about, what exactly are we talking about?
We're talking two things. The history of planned genocide in Canada, where over 50,000 children died in state and church-run Indian boarding schools between about 1890 and 1996, when the last one was closed. We're also talking about my story of how I discovered this as a United Church minister, how I was eventually thrown out of the church for bringing forward these stories, and trying to show how really the stories were intertwined, just like the story of whites and Indians in Canada are very connected. Kind of a microcosm of that, of what had happened that you know, to led to this final exposure of these crimes.
And what were some of the crimes, just for detail purposes?
Well, I mean, they're everything that is described under international law as genocide. We're talking about outright killings of children, putting them in conditions where they were starving every day, they were receiving no education, rampant torture, regular gang rape by staff, medical experimentation, sterilization programs where any Indian who wouldn't go to church was targeted for sterilization. All of these things, you know.
So a little bit of mind control as well.
Absolutely. They were, and Native people were used, especially in the 1950s and 60s, for MKUltra. Experiments in Montreal, here in Ontario, all across the West, in Indian hospitals where these sterilizations and other things were going on. We had access to those records until right after our first tribunal in 1998. The government suddenly closed, officially sealed all the records of the Indian hospitals. You can't access them anymore without security clearance. So it shows you that they're definitely hiding a lot of stuff related to what they're doing in these places.
And you can't get anything through the Freedom of Information?
No, there's certain things that they will not allow public access to, and now the hospital, Indian hospital records, require an application to Prime Minister's office. I tried going to the National Archives in Ottawa just last year, and the librarian said you can't see that stuff anymore.
Sure, well, that's against the law of activism.
Well, there's matters that they don't let access to if it's considered
national security.
Now, don't forget that's a military term, and a lot of these hospitals and experiments were being run under the auspices of the military in conjunction with the U.S. military. So that's one of the reasons that, you know, they're not letting them in.
That's true. They can sweep it under that rug because it was part of the American and Canadian MKUltra program that had military funding that was using universities and professors from universities who had assigned the security acts, so they wouldn't really reveal any of that information. And those are 25-year, signed on the dotted line. I won't say anything for 25 years. They're pretty much locked down.
Well, yeah, and these were heavily funded by the CIA. That's all being proved now as part of their program.
Sure.
So Indian kids were an easy group to access. It wasn't Indians only.
No, of course.
But they were certainly targeted. Yeah.
They were part of a target group.
Yeah.
One of many target groups. Now, didn't they also try to limit them or stop them from practicing their belief system, the Indian belief system, as well as speak their language?
Well, that was implicit right from the very beginning. Just a little bit of history. During about a 10-year period in the 1880s, when the Canadian Pacific Railway finally linked the country, the Indian Act, Indian reservation systems, the residential schools were all created, and the RCMP were created as a national paramilitary police force whose main mandate was to clear off all the Indians within 50 miles of the railway to allow white settlement very rapidly. Now, in the West, that's where most of the residential schools were located. These aren't schools, first of all, remember. That's a term the government created as mind fog. These were internment camps where the deliberate strategy was to separate take the young generation of natives and kill off at least half of them, depopulate the areas that were targeted for, you know, settlement and resource extraction and things like that. Then take the remnant and turn them into a brainwashed aboriginal group. Now, aboriginal means not of the original group. So you have a different mindset. You've had the mind of the colonial conqueror put in your head. And when you look at the so-called native political leadership these days, you can see what the end result of that was. People who have lost their traditions and their language, they see themselves as part of Canada. They don't see, like the Mohawk people around here, the traditionalists say, we've never been part of Canada. This is Ogwahanwin land, the land of the true people, as they call it. And they don't recognize the jurisdiction of Canada here. But most Native leaders are on the government payroll. They've been the main ones who opposed any investigation into the deaths of their own relatives in the residential schools. So only a brainwashed population would think in those terms or operate like that. And that was the purpose of the the camps, the Christian internment camps, if you like. Mm-hmm. They were a massive mind control experiment. And implicit in that was you were tortured and killed if you spoke your own language. You know, if you identify in any way with your culture, if you tried to get home, the RCMP would chase you down and bring you back, usually punishment that often resulted in death. This is happening. I mean, to give you one example of this, I was speaking to a woman today who told one story of what happened right here in Brantford. This is the oldest residential school right here in Brantford. set up by the Church of England in 1832, closed in 1970. So the Queen is directly responsible as head of state for what happened here. This one woman, Lorna McDonald, said that she watched while a little girl was drowned in a bucket of water. Her face was kept down in a bucket of water. At other times, the kids were forced to stand together and given electric shocks twice a month, just random torture. And there were other tales of kids. There's even a story. Lorna came on the new radio 2 weeks ago and said that her brother Rufus saw Canadian soldiers take out children from the school in 1943 and shoot them and put them in a ditch about a mile from here in what's called the Glebe site. Now, we've gone over there and looked at that site. We've done test digs, and we found human remains. A local archaeologist has identified these as children's bones mixed in with potash, which was used back then to dissolve bodies. So there's direct evidence now that there was a mass grave here, and it was a result of killings. Now, this is the first time in Canada we've documented that kind of story, but where there's smoke, there's fire. And we're going to hope that other groups are going to be wanting to do the excavations to other native groups.
If more people come to you and tell you stories, they can give you clues as to where the next place is to look. Now, just to be clear, this is in Brantford, Ontario, Canada, where we are right now.
Yep.
And you've been going to these sites just over the last couple of days. Is this what you've been doing the last couple of days?
Well, it actually started, I came here 4 years ago.
Okay.
I've been giving talks and meeting people here. And what's good about the Mohawks here of the Grand River is for years they've been fighting to preserve their dwindling land base. They were originally given 1 million acres around here under what's called the Haldimand Treaty, because they sided with the British in the Revolutionary War in the States. And then after the generals Washington and Clinton drove the Mohawks out of New York, they settled here. The British gave them this land that they said would be theirs until the end of time. Well, of the 1 million acres, it's only 30,000 left, about 3% of the land base. So they fight all the time to preserve their land. They stand in front of tractors and bulldozers. There's been a big land reclamation movement here. Those very same people are the ones who invited me in. Back in April, I got a letter from the 9 of the elders here, asking me to come and do investigations, including archaeological digs on this site, in order to take that evidence, help repatriate the children's remains for a proper burial, and then take that evidence to Europe to human rights investigations so that we can charge Canada and the Church of England, the Catholics, the Anglican, and the United Church with crimes against humanity. So this has been a long process, but we're beginning it. We're commencing digs this week.
Now, just to be clear.
Yeah.
They went from how much land? Over a million?
Over 1 million acres to less than 30,000 now.
To 30,000?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Uh-huh. And it's shrinking every day. This week, some of the elders are going out to stand at just down the road here where they're trying to build a hotel on their land. They go in. They don't ask the Mohawk people at all. They just start building on the land. And unless they're confronted physically, they just go ahead because the law is all on the side of...
Right. Yeah, but Canadian...
The whites.
You know... Land claims, you have paperwork you have to fill out, you know? So how could they possibly just go and...
How could they set up schools where 50,000 children die? I mean, they do it because under the law, Indians aren't citizens. Under the Indian Act, you're a ward of the state. So if you live on reservation, which you have to if you want to get government money, you're not a citizen. You're in the same legal category as a child or a mentally incompetent person. You can't do anything without Ottawa's approval.
Right.
So they can do anything they want. The Crown, in the Indian Act, the first words are, all land is vested in the Crown. And that's true anywhere in Canada.
Yeah,
6 months or 6 inches of the soil can be owned by you. But beneath 6 inches, it's all Crown land, all the resources. Traditionally, that was the depth of a plow.
Yeah.
So they could let us be farmers to till the earth, but we don't actually own it.
Mm.
Only the Crown does. So it's this huge corporation that's responsible for this genocide, and is responsible for keeping us all paupers in our own land, and, you know, indebted slaves, if you like, right? So it's the same, I think it's the same genocide. It's always been about the land.
Yeah, land, resources,
yeah.
Space, whatever. You know, they just want more area.
Yeah.
And the building's continuing, you know? They're spreading out, and they're encroaching upon what little land they did give them.
Yeah.
Like they had the right to give land, or take it for that matter. So what are the complaints nowadays? What's the current issues? Because a lot of what you were talking about in the documentary, I would think that what you're seeing now is just more of the same, or are there, you know, it's more widespread than what you originally found out.
Yeah, well, there's two things. There's the crimes that have happened and the crimes that are still going on. And that's why I call my book Hidden No Longer, Genocide in Canada, Past and Present. And this has got all of the evidence that I've accumulated over 15 years. It's at hiddennolonger.com.
And we'll have a link to that
right
on our website in the upcoming guest section.
Yep.
The day after the show, it will be in the past guest section.
Yep.
So if anybody wants to go with that, they can order it.
Well, let me give you an example of this. In the book, in terms of past crimes, here's a chart that was done by Dr. Peter Bryce, who is a government, he was the top medical officer for the Ontario government. And he went out on a tour of all the Western residential schools twice, in 1907 and 1909. And he found that half the children were dying regularly in every school. Because of there's a figure right there describing half the children dead in one Alberta residential school, the blood reserve.
Half of them.
Half of them. And according to this, 38 were alive and 36 were dead. Now, the reason Dr. Bryce said that was happening is because of a practice deliberately housing children who are healthy with the sick and dying, and then allowing, never treating them. So they died en masse. And that happened over 50 years. So, you know, when the government and the churches now pretend that these children just died because of lack of funding, it wasn't intentional, it was just this, you know, kind of an accident. They have to answer the question, how come that went on for 50 years then, if it was just a matter of underfunding? I mean, clearly there was an intent. It doesn't go on for that long unless it was intentional. Another piece of evidence about that, here's a copy of an order in council from 1919 abolishing medical inspection in the residential schools. After the report had come out that Dr. Bryce reported that these were horrible health conditions and was being deliberately created to spread disease, they then abolished medical inspection. And as a result, this is a TB rate in the Indian world in British Columbia after the abolition of the medical inspection. Look what happens. The tuberculosis rate increases dramatically. So all of that, you know, in the 10 years after that, they bring in compulsory sterilization laws, compulsory attendance. They force everybody into the schools even though they're death traps.
Mm.
And they abolish legal control of native parents over their own kids. And they transfer the guardianship rights to the churches from the government. So they're giving the churches carte blanche to do anything. You couldn't hire a lawyer if you're in India. It's all created to wipe out people. And there's no more concrete evidence than that.
Right.
Yet they're still saying it wasn't intentional.
It's not a eugenics program. Really,
it's absurd.
No, it's not.
No.
And I think the eugenics program is a real, real thing. And I think it's more widespread than people are aware.
And, you know, it's right in the laws. Like, here's another thing I found. This is the sterilization law in British Columbia, 1933. And same year as Adolf Hitler came to power, interestingly. The sterilization laws in North America were copied in Europe during the 30s and 40s. These laws allowed the sterilization of any native child in a residential school at the decision of one man, the principal. And
okay, now let me get this straight. Yeah. The principal of the internment, I'm sorry, school, was able to just say across the board, sterilize children?
Yes.
Above or below this age?
Any age. Usually the standard policy was when children reached puberty, they were sterilized, especially if they weren't going to church and they were traditional, holding on to their language. They were targeted. The traditional chiefs were targeted for that eugenics program. And also I've interviewed people in British Columbia and Alberta both from different areas who said the same thing. If their marks were too high, they were given a red tag. They had to report to the infirmary. They were sterilized. So the program of wiping out the more intelligent group members of a group.
Their marks were too high.
Too high. If they got very high marks, they were sterilized. That was reported in the Alberni Residential School run by the United Church and in the LeJack School run by the Catholic Church in British Columbia. So, I mean, you know, that's a sure sign of genocide when you're targeting a group like that to make them infertile.
And did you have the opportunity to interview a lot of people that had this done to them?
A few of them. In our movie Unrepentant, we quote four of them. And these people, naturally, especially the women, they're very, you know, they carry a lot of shame about that. And
very sensitive about it.
So they didn't actually appear on the screen, but we have their affidavit statements. Mm-hmm. And I've met these people. There's whole clusters of them who survived these things on Vancouver Island, especially.
And since then? And since the film? You've met quite a few people.
Well, more people come forward all the time. Mm-hmm. There really isn't enough time in the day to interview all these people.
Yeah.
The people who contact me, I don't have the money or the means to get around mm-hmm. to interview everybody. And now that the government has set up their phony Truth and Reconciliation Commission, everybody's thinking that's some kind of investigation, but it isn't. When you read their mandate, they have no power to subpoena documents, so the churches can decide what to show them. The churches even helped appoint the commissioners. So it's kind of like the serial killer getting to appoint the jury and the judge. You can't name names. You can't talk about wrongdoing that happened in the school. And the churches are absolved from any wrongdoing. You can't sue them anymore for any of this stuff. So that's set up to protect the perpetrator, not to bring out the truth. You know.
So that's like, we'll talk about it under our rules.
Exactly.
And our rules are so stringent that nobody's going to be...
We're not guilty of anything.
They're going to be some random thing happened, allegedly, and these people that we can't talk about were involved, who were members of a group, we're not going to say their name.
Well, there's no... It's kind of like you can, at a TRC forum, and I've been to these are like, a lot of hoopla in the media about these events, but all they are when you go, people will get up at the mic, they're given 5 minutes to speak usually, and the commissioners can hear what they have to say, but they can't record it as evidence. So, you know, it's fine, like, oh yeah, talk away, whatever you like, but it has no legal outcome. It has no consequence. Especially when the churches have already been absolved from any wrongdoing. So what difference does it make if you do an investigation? It's like saying, Peter Yellickwell is a friend of mine in Manitoba, and he got up at the mic and he said, you know what, an apology and healing and reconciliation in Canada is like, it's like if somebody steals your car. They come and knock on your door and say, gee, I'm really sorry I stole your car, and then they get in and drive it away again. You know, it's like there's no concept, nothing changes, but they've said all the correct words, and then everyone thinks, oh, my conscience is absolved. Doesn't change it. As a matter of fact, it makes it worse because the people I work with, when the compensation money began to come into the neighborhood in Vancouver where I worked, the alcoholism and drug abuse rate went way up. People started overdosing. You know, if you give $10,000 to somebody in the street, what do you think they're going to do with it? It's not enough for them to change their life. It's only enough to kill yourself with. And that's what I see on the ground all the time.
Okay.
So it's money thrown at individuals is a way to continue wiping out people. It's not a way to change anything.
Yeah, but I mean, that's why, in most reservations, nothing has changed.
It's not meant to change.
There's absolutely no meant to change. Because it's all the money that just goes in and just gets funneled into abuse. And the chiefs and a lot of these people are not really helping in progressing the situation.
Well, the ones that are hooked into the governing council, as it were, they're sort of on board with the politicians. I mean, they become politicians,
you know. Chief and council, it's important to know, under the Indian Act, if you're elected chief and band council funded by Indian Affairs, you are a legal agent of the Crown of England. Just like a member of parliament is, the policeman, you know, the oath of allegiance to a member of parliament is, I would swear true allegiance to Queen Elizabeth and her descendants, not to the people of Canada, not to the Constitution. So in effect, we are electing and paying for people who are not accountable to us, but to a foreign power.
Yeah.
Same with, there is no difference between that person, member of parliament, and a band council chief. Mm. They're both serving the crown. So it doesn't really matter what they decide. It has no... We can't affect that legally. Right.
So who are the spiritual... I mean, if they're handling the political leadership, who are the spiritual leaders?
The real spiritual leaders in the community are the traditional elders who have survived somehow. They've survived better in the East than in Western Canada. They were almost obliterated in the West. But in the East, you know, the Mohawks, the Six Nations Confederacy, hung on to a lot of their traditions because they were military allies of the British. They were able to get concessions that people in the West couldn't. And so they've retained some of that. The clan mothers here were the ones who invited me in. They're the ones who say, and it was interesting, when they began the archaeological dig here at the Brantford School, they said right at the outset in a press release, we will not allow the RCMP onto this territory to declare it a crime site. We don't recognize the jurisdiction of Canada. This is under Ongwahanwe or Mohawk jurisdiction, and it always has been. So we have security here to protect the archaeological site. You know, that we're going to be digging.
But what are the the laws when it comes to, the reservations? Are they...
They're Crown lands.
They're still Crown lands.
Yeah, Indian reservations are held in, they say, in trust for Indians, like you're a child, we're holding in trust for you. But it's all authorities vested in the Crown. All land, including on reservations, is owned by the Crown.
So the RCMP still has...
Well, in their legal system of the Crown, you know, they will claim that they do. But the point is, it's interesting, this building we're in right now has been occupied for 3 years by the Clan Mothers. The government's never turned off the electricity. The RCMP will not, they'll come to the end of the driveway, but they won't enter the premises because they know this is Mohawk land. And they don't want to force the issue in court because if it is forced, they'll have to bring up the whole Haldimand Tract, which was illegally signed away by a guy called Governor Bond Head in the 1840s. He illegally just went, no, it's not Mohawk land. If that issue was forced in court, every treaty since then has been fraudulent. Now, Canada doesn't want that proven in court. So they occupy a gray zone where they won't enforce it, but they won't back off either. They kind of hang on the edges, hoping people forget history and won't act on their rights and will be caught up in this false jurisdiction of the chief and council. Just like we do in the white society, you know, when we use our driver's license with the capital letters and all that.
Yeah.
It's the same fiction.
Or all of our bills that we get in capital letters.
It is the same fiction.
Yeah, it's a fiction. It's the straw man.
Right.
They're sending bills to the straw man.
Yeah.
Our listeners are...
Well,
are up on all of
it's
that.
It's the same system here in the Aboriginal world, too. And fortunately, there are some people here in the Native world as well who've woken up to that, who have always been aware of it, right? And they just simply say, well, this will be conducted under our jurisdiction. So it's exciting because it hasn't happened like that anywhere in Canada yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to allow us to be able to take this evidence, you know, outside the country, which is what you need to do because the courts have colluded in concealing this whole genocide.
Well, Not too long ago, when the H1N1 situation had occurred, I had heard of a story, and I guess it was on the radio here for a while, when the government had shipped a whole bunch of caskets to one of the reservations out in BC.
Body bags.
Yeah. Not that knowing that they would get that H1. No, was that reservation had an awful lot of...
Well, I was involved in that, actually, documenting that, because it happened at the Housed Indian Reservation, where when I was a minister, I used to work up there. I used to do funerals and weddings out at the Housed Reserve, and it's one of the most isolated places on the West Coast, and yet it's the first place they declared a pandemic zone.
Pandemic.
Now, how would that happen?
I couldn't figure that out.
Okay, the reason that happened is for about a year before that, Health Canada nurses had been going and pushing the Tamiflu vaccine on people, targeting them, because under the Indian Act, Section 76, if you're on reserve, you cannot refuse medical treatment. So they are built-in guinea pigs. They can't legally refuse. They could if they knew their nature, but because they're residential school and their own chief and council, they're all brainwashed to think they have to follow the authority of Canada. And they go in there, and they were giving people this drug, and a lot of them came down with a swine flu. So they were testing it out, and that's something a lot of people don't know about, that they were using.
This was like, when I first heard of it, because that was in the early stages when supposedly, you know, it was coming out of Mexico, and, you know, a few people had gone down there, and you know, I think it was maybe about a few weeks later, not even that long maybe, and I heard the story, and I said to myself, you know, how is it possible that you know, this flu kind of like jumped. I mean, how many natives go to Mexico?
Well, it's illustrating the fact that for a long time, indigenous people have been like the canary in the mine shaft.
Yeah, sure.
They're the main target to try out a lot of stuff. Drug testing programs, experimental birth control devices were always tried out first in these Indian hospitals.
No, but this is the funny thing is when they were talking about that bird flu, that it wasn't a manufactured type of... You know, thanks. So how does it get the people that are so isolated
introduced?
It was introduced with the Tamiflu injections, and
That's what they were doing when they first tested it back in 90 whatever in Europe.
Well, we know that here's a fact a lot of people don't know, that the drug pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, have agreements with churches all over the world. There's a thing called the Institute for the Fund for Theological Education in America, and it funds all the seminaries. It's Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company. There's an agreement that has been for many years between the United Church and the Catholic Church to use kids in residential schools as drug testing guinea pigs. And that's how they would often try out these new drugs on groups provided by the government, the military, the churches. That's one of the reasons the churches go ballistic at the sound of my name, because they know that I'm sitting on this evidence. And this is not about sexual abuse that can be resolved with a bit of money and apology. it's about crimes against humanity. And so in a true and just world, these churches, the heads of these churches would be in prison right now. They'd be facing trial for doing exactly what the Nazis or the Pol Pot or any of these
they've
people
have
done.
They've been doing it for hundreds of years. Right? Not like
it's not new.
Well, they've had a lot of practice.
Yeah.
Why are you being so good at it? And they're sort of dead to it. I mean, emotionally, they can set it.
Yeah.
They can. I mean, because you or me, I couldn't order any of this. I couldn't participate in any of this. I couldn't even be aware of it and allow it to continue. So this gets a bit into the psychology of it.
Right. Yeah, but it's power, right? I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're...
Power at a cost, you know, I mean, what's your opinion? What is the cost? And how can they have that sort of... That thought process.
What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose their soul? I mean, it doesn't, but I don't believe we're dealing with human beings in a conventional sense, because when you're... And I saw this up close, my fellow clergy, they all backed off except one guy who, you know, when I got fired, he went to bat for me, and he lost his job for doing it as well. Mm-hmm. But all of these other clergy really had lost their capacity to make a personal moral choice that went up against the institution. They had surrendered their own conscience for the sake of this institution, and that's a form of possession. You know, I think in a very basic sense, these institutions are, and when you look at their impact in the world, they're like demonic entities, and they have the power to possess if you give them your allegiance. Because why else, or how else, could clergy who talk about the love of Jesus and supposed to act like humanitarian people turn around and know these crimes against children occurred, know that child trafficking is still going on, know that any child rapist in the church is automatically protected? There was a man in the United Church who, right here in Ontario for 30 years, Russell Crossley, his name was, he was a minister all through southern Ontario. Every time he raped women in his congregation, he was protected by the United Church officers and moved around. He was eventually brought to trial in Victoria the same year I got defrocked. He never got defrocked for raping his congregation, but I did for bringing out the truth of this thing.
For talking about it, yeah.
He went back, he did 3 months in jail, he went back, welcomed back to his congregation, he retired on full pension in 2006. So what kind of institution does that and allows the torture and killing of children? Yeah, certainly nothing, no group that has anything to do with Jesus Christ.
When you talk directly to these clergy, what is their justification? How do they justify?
They won't talk to me anymore, but back then.
Back then?
They don't try, first of all, they deny. It's like any, it's like talking to people who have terminal cancer. There's ages, the whole stages of anger and denial you go through. And you'll stay stuck in anger and denial unless somebody comes to you and gets you to see the truth and accept your ending. Well, it's exactly the same here, because they out denied. When I first showed them the evidence, they just denied. They said the church couldn't do that. Well, here's statistics showing half the children died. They say, oh, it was just due to lack of funding. They continually rationalize in their mind to avoid looking at the fact that it was a conscious decision. Christians took children, put them in these institutions, murdered them, and justified it all along. Because you can use religion to justify anything.
Mm.
Because that's if true. God's on your side, you have the right to wipe out anybody. That's in our tradition.
Yeah, yeah.
And God's on your side.
He'll save you in the end.
Well, it's not Christians do it, Muslims do it. Anybody who thinks God's on their side will do this.
And I noticed your point. Is that...
That's my... I was going to hold that up. This
was
is the,
that your...
This is my little plastic piece here. I have a Superman when I put that on.
So. Oh, wow. Yeah, and you change your whole...
That's not good. So I better throw that away.
No, you should keep that. That's a good reminder.
I use this on protests, because under the Canadian Criminal Code, if I'm a minister engaged in my function, if I'm stopped, I can be... The person who doesn't can be arrested and go to jail for 2 years. So... I like to wear this on protest to say to the police, you know,
if you arrest me,
you're violating your criminal code.
2 years in jail for you, pal. That's
but,
great.
But
yeah,
like right now, once you got fired from the United Church, does that no longer
well,
make you?
No, I'm.
How do you take God out of man?
I think it made me more of what I was believing in, actually, to lose my job from a child raping institution. But all they did was take away my livelihood, my ability to earn a living. They didn't take away the ordination, so I still do a lot of that function as a community minister, but not in a church. That's
not in a church. No.
No.
Well, you're so busy now traveling around. You're have you, you've been traveling around all over Canada. Have you any other, tell us where you've been.
All over the States and Europe. In the last 3 years, I've spent a lot of time in Europe, in London, Ireland, all over Europe. We picketed the Vatican on two occasions. Had a symbolic exorcism there, which was really fun.
That's cool.
That was covered in all the media all over Europe. And that's one of the reasons that we're having the support we are now, because the world is aware of this now.
Right.
We didn't allow it to stay confined to Port Alberni or Canada, but this is a global phenomenon of child torture and murders.
And has been a
long time. Yep.
For a very long
century.
Time. How do you feel about everything now, looking back on it? Do you feel that you've found your place, that this is that this is what you're meant to do? Do you feel happy in your heart?
I always have. I always felt good inside that I did the right thing, because even when I lost my kids and my family and my livelihood and faced all these attacks, poverty, the whole bit, you can live with that if you can live with yourself. And I always was able to look at myself in the mirror. I still am. And I'm able to look at my children, and they're, I know that my daughters are grown up now, they're in college, and I'm telling them the whole story. So I do feel good. I'd do it again. And it feels good to be liberated from your complicity in a murderous institution.
Right.
And that complicity is something we all have to look at and find a way of separating ourselves from, or these crimes continue. So, yeah, it was the right choice, and it's... I just hope more people will make that choice, because it's needed. You know, this isn't just some superhero act by me. I just did what I thought was right, and more people can do that, I think.
And there are other people.
Yeah.
There are other people out there doing that. You know, speaking about it, talking about it. But I'm sure because you're a public face now, you must get bombarded with emails and letters
all the time,
and phone calls.
They run about 99-1 in favor. I only occasionally get, I get death threats, I get attacked, you know, there's the usual kind of harassment that goes on, but it's overwhelmingly supportive because people can't deny this stuff anymore, you know.
So. Have you had any very serious threats? Mm-hmm. Yeah? What sort of examples? I mean, with the kind of radio show we have, our guests will always, we have free energy inventors on our show.
Oh yeah, well.
And, you want to talk about something dangerous.
Oh, sure, yeah, because they're threatening big oil and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Physical attacks, an enormous smear campaign, misinformation campaign directed at Native people so they won't talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
Censorship, you know, attempts to... Well, my family was broken up. All my network tends to get targeted if I get too influential.
Mm-hmm. Maybe let's start from the beginning. Like, the history of how
that
this whole
thing
came down.
Yeah.
Well, I talked about some of it already. I mean, in terms of, I wrote a letter to the church about their stealing Native land and selling it off to
logging companies. But how did you start into this? Like, how did you start investigating, or how did you come up with
it? The very first instance of it, I think, is
that... Oh, I talk about it in my film on Repentance,
where
the very first Native home I visited, they told me a story of a Native child being killed. That was in the fall of 1992, a man called Danny Gus. He said he saw his best friend beaten to death and buried in the hill behind the school by a United Church minister. And the clergy know about it, and all the church people know, and that's why they weren't inviting him into the church. I had asked him why there were no Indians in any of the white churches, and he said that's one of the reasons.
Mm.
Because they're all guilty, they know about what happened in these schools, camps. And it just started from there. At that point, I could have decided to just ignore it.
Yeah, there's two roads you could have taken.
But
you could have said, okay, I'll just... do my sermons to the white congregation, and
I was told
that's none of my business. That was their history. I'll just leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Or the road you did take.
I could have, if you don't mind the saying, I could have left my balls at the door and continued to be a clergy. But that's actually expected. You know, ministers are to be the servant of everybody. They're not to do anything to rock the boat, and that's understood. That's part of the job description. But it seems a strange. Way to be if you're to be a moral example in the community and preach from the Bible, which is Jesus was not a pussyfoot. You know, he confronted the powers of his day and he got killed for it.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, how dare they quote the man, right?
Yeah.
When they're going to act like you know, spiritual eunuchs,
mm-hmm.
and moral idiots. So,
yeah.
And that's in fact the camp most of them are still in.
The camp most of them are still in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did the attacks that continue on you after that when you came home?
Well, I mean, it was as soon as it was clear that the church was going to remove me, they went to my ex-wife and helped to pay for her divorce. They said they'd help her with her divorce if she left me, and provided them with information, which she agreed to. So I lost custody of my two daughters. They were only 6 and 3 at the time. They went around and made sure I didn't complete my PhD at the University of British Columbia, which in a way was a good thing because it allowed me to publish this.
And right, make it public. Gave me time.
And I took all of this, was going to be a PhD thesis, and put it out in the community, so that was better. But it was a horrible time for me personally, and it was designed to destroy me, to make me either kill myself or just fade into oblivion and crawl away and die, which is what most whistleblowers do in that situation. Because it's what they did is right out of the tech, the handbook of how do you deal with a corporate whistleblower. And it's not unusual. But by bringing so much attention to me, they didn't calculate that by not going under, what they were doing to me was actually fueling the fire.
Yeah.
And the more they attacked me, the more it helped. And it's that kind of jiu-jitsu move. The more they bring attention on me, the more it brings this truth out. So they, frankly, I think at this point don't know what to do because they can't kill me. It'll make me a martyr. I'm too well known.
Right.
If they ignore me, this truth keeps getting out. So they're really in a quandary. And the main people that have to protect them, the church and government, are the native leaders. Because they can act like, and what they often do, the government-funded natives will say, oh, we don't support Kevin Annett. He doesn't speak for Indians, only we do. Well, I never claimed to speak for anybody but myself and addressing my culture about the crimes we did. So they have their native puppets, and they're their main front line of defense. But the reality is that most natives and whites now realize that they've been complicit in these crimes, and they want to do something about it. They know this government TRC is.
Have you seen a change in that?
Yes.
Since the, say, 4 years ago?
Ever
has
since.
Has there been an evolution?
Yeah. In 10 years ago, when we started doing protests outside churches, we got a lot of harassment from people. Nowadays, when we go out, virtually everyone going into that church nods, doesn't say anything. The police come, they look the other way, they can't look us in the eye. We've even had cops come up and tell us they're behind what we're doing, you know, and people in the church all the time. So, I mean, that even happened in Rome when we were there, you know.
In Rome?
The Vatican.
Tell us about the Vatican.
Well, I mean, I went there first in October 2009, and I did a symbolic exorcism. And it was interesting, the next day, for the first time in 40 years, a tornado hit the center of Rome.
Yeah.
And people said, hey, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. You got some mojo.
For whatever reason it happened, it certainly caused a tempest because I got a call that week from a fairly senior cardinal in the church who said that, you know, they had gotten our letter because we had written to the Pope asking for him to identify where these children were buried who had died in Catholic schools. Never heard back from him, but the cardinal contacted me through a back channel and he said that they'd be willing to talk about it at some point. But that same month, whether or not, again, it's related to what we did in Rome, but the first news stories began to hit about how the Pope, Joseph Ratzinger, is personally involved in covering up the torture and abuse of children in the Catholic Church, ordering bishops to cover that up and not tell the police. His signature's on the letter. So he's personally on the line for this. And after that, the church went into damage control mode and they didn't talk
about it. Then any work with you guys was
right
out the window.
It caused a breach. And to show you, when I went back there in the next April, when we gathered again, the state police showed up, swarmed us, wouldn't let us near the Vatican, and wouldn't let us talk to the reporters. They were getting really worried at that point. But this coming April, there's going to be an international convergence of survivors on Rome. On April 8th, which is Easter.
April 8th.
And they're going to try to form a human chain around the Vatican.
Now, if there's people that want to get involved in that, who do they contact you?
They could contact me, Kevin_Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, at hotmail.com. You can follow on our tribunal website, the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State. It has a website, itccs.org.
Okay.
And that's on the card. I'm sure you could post that for people.
Yeah, I'll be posting all of your links.
And that ITCCS site is the one to keep updated about all of this because we have reports from all over the world. We work with groups in 5 countries. They're all doing this work. A group in Ireland have organized occupations of churches, protests, and that's one of the reasons the Irish government severed diplomatic relations in Rome with the Vatican, if you can believe it.
Oh, really?
They withdrew their ambassador from Rome last month. They said recently they're going to bring in a law where a priest will go to jail for 5 years if they don't disclose child abuse. Now, that's unprecedented in Ireland. And that shows you the effect that we're having in this whole campaign. People are really demanding change now.
Okay, you've got some cases in your book, and I'd like to talk about them. There's one about a guy named John Sheephumper. Sheep Shanks. If we could get some information on him and that case.
Yeah, well, this man was an Anglican church missionary from England. He lived from 1834 to 1909. He was one of the early Anglican missionaries in British Columbia. He was also a member of an inside clique that involved members of the government, the early colonial government there. And they were all part of the Anglican Church, and they were all shareholders in something called the Puget Sound Land Company, which was owned by the Hudson's Bay Company. Now, what this man did in a nutshell is he went among the interior British Columbia Indians, the Chilcotin Native people. There was, at the time, about 10,000 of them. And within a year of his arrival, that was down to a few hundred. Because what he did is he deliberately inoculated them with smallpox. And he kept a journal about this, how he did it. He inoculated these Indians. And prior to the inoculation, he and his company, fellow company shareholders, had preempted the land. Now, in Canadian history, you can preempt land if there's nobody on it. If it's owned by an Indian family and a missionary came and built a house there, they would preempt it, the government would give it to them, the crown. But in this case, they preempted it before any of the people had died, which they couldn't do under the law. But it was allowed because the government knew that these Indians were all about to die. Because Sheepshanks was a guy on the ground killing them all off. So he described how we went in a big arc. And this researcher in Quesnel, British Columbia, Ben Swanky, he's a librarian there, he went through all the newspaper archives and documented this systematically. He's done a movie about it, and he goes around BC lecturing about it. But
What's the name of the movie? Do you remember?
I've got to look it up. I will. I'll look at that.
Okay,
for
we'll get that.
But Swanky tells me is, and shows in the book, is that, it's Tom Swanky.
Okay.
A librarian in Quesnel, British Columbia. So Tom Swanky showed that when Sheepshanks kept this diary of how he was inoculating all the Indians, he went in a big arc all the way around British Columbia like this. Right. And you follow the arc of his activity, and it's where the smallpox epidemics broke out. And all of the land that he was inoculating on had been preempted by the Puget Sound Land Company. So in the case of the whole town of Quesnel, BC, it's a vast killing ground caused by this Anglican missionary, John Sheepshanks. Now, what's interesting is he not only got a payoff in a lot of land, but later in life, he became an archbishop in England. He became the Bishop of Norwich, and he sat in the House of Lords. So he was paid off big time for doing this.
So he was rewarded
at the behest of the crown. He was acting at the behest of the crown. Otherwise, why would he have been allowed into the House of Lords and be given that position in the British establishment after?
Right.
So that is an example from Canadian history of how the genocide happened. It was deliberate. It was planned by a church working with colonial governments and land companies. And it's interesting, when the United Church of Canada was formed in 1925, if you look at the United Church of Canada Act, brought in by the Parliament, it gives the United Church the powers of a bank. They can make money, they can issue promissory notes. I often wonder, why would the church be a bank? Well, if you're the first ones into an area and you're grabbing all this land, you become land brokers.
Of course.
Right.
So that's behind the mask of these churches. They launder money, they deal in stolen land. That's the issue that got me fired. I discovered that the church had been doing that. Yeah. The reason the boot came down on me so quick is they thought, oh boy, if he discovers this history of church corporate collusion, he's going to discover this one day.
Right.
And sure enough, it came out anyway, but that's why I was wondering, why were they firing me without cause and destroying my family? For writing a letter.
Yeah.
And in another place, it wouldn't have caused as much of a problem. But in that place, it definitely was exposing the church's history of this kind of collusion.
So there was more points to the story that they didn't want you to dig too deep.
That's right.
Because if you did, you would find out all of these other connections, as well as the connection of... we were talking earlier about smallpox. Mm-hmm. And... and blankets, and also tuberculosis. Maybe you could give us some of those points.
Oh, well, there's another case right here in eastern Canada. And it's again described in my film Unrepentant, which you can see on any Google search.
Yeah.
And on hiddenfromhistory.org. The British general, Geoffrey Amherst, went in 1749, he was fighting the Mi'kmaq Indians to drive them off their land. And he kept a journal, which is now being quoted and published by the Mi'kmaq people. And in it, he ordered a Major Bouquet, who was his subordinate, to go into the hospitals, get smallpox-laden blankets, and distribute them among the Mi'kmaq. And he describes how he did that. So we reprinted part of the journal in my book. And, you know, Amherst went on to become a big guy. Amherst, Nova Scotia, is named after him. His picture is in all the portrait galleries over in England, you know, as a great hero who fought the French and the Indians. Mm. But, you know, out in no-term warfare, and that's how Canada was founded, on that kind of mass murder. Just like America.
Just like America.
Yeah.
So this is all through North America. Europe as well, I mean.
And South America. And
South America.
As well.
Yeah.
And the Vatican especially. I mean, that it came out of Rome, this whole mentality. The papal bulls in the 1400s that authorized all this was based on the assumption that if you weren't a Christian or a Catholic Christian, you didn't have a right to your own land. You occupied it, but you didn't own it because
right.
you weren't a Christian. I mean, that was explicitly
said. It went hand in hand with the crown.
Right.
I mean, the crowned and the royals it was the right hand and the left hand, weren't they?
That's right.
More, and then they controlled the military and through the politicians
mm-hmm.
that got into power.
Here's an example of that Amherst diary. That's Jeffrey Amherst on the bottom and his excerpt from his journal. And the quote is, "You will do well to try to inoculate the Indians by means of blankets, as well as to try every other method that can serve to extirpate, that's kill, this execrable race." Oh, it says also, "I should be very glad your scheme for hunting them down with dogs could take effect." You know, so they were using dogs and smallpox blankets to kill off all the Mi'kmaqs they could find.
Right. They didn't even consider them humans,
no.
did they? They certainly didn't treat them as humans.
Well, in practice, we still don't. You know.
The current, and connecting to the current problems that are still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And what are some of the current problems that are still going on?
Oh, with Native people?
Yeah.
Well, a death rate that's just as high as it ever was 50 years ago.
And why is that?
Well, because
you think they're still using them as guinea pigs, like you
they
said?
They are. Well, you know, take for an example, in the destruction of the families is continuing at an ever-increasing pace. There's more Native children in white foster homes now than there were children in residential schools. I work with Native families where the police can come in and take the child out of the arms of the mother and never go through any review procedure or any legal process because they're Indians. How many Native people are killed in police custody? Vancouver has the highest rate of death in police custody of any city,
yeah.
and two-thirds of them are Native.
Really?
Yeah, I've listened to numerous shows on
yeah.
CBC.
Yeah. So people say, why does that happen in BC? Well, it was the frontier. It never changed, this plan of open season on Indians. Most of the homeless people in Vancouver I work with have been forced off their land by their own chiefs who signed deals with water companies, oil companies, timber companies
right.
to get the land.
Hydro companies
mm-hmm.
to
yeah,
get that.
Alcan 2, Kamana 2 project, that happened. They went in and flooded the land without even telling the Indians because they made a deal with the chief. You know, that
right.
happens all the time.
Right.
Happens here too.
Yeah, yeah, because one of the descriptions I had through this friend of mine up in Waffle Island is that, you know, the chiefs are, you know, in control, whereas the, you know, the little people don't have nothing. They can sometimes they have to walk a few miles just to go buy food in the winter.
Yep.
Because they don't have a car, they don't have nothing.
What
well,
can they do?
In 1991, let me just
go ahead
on that. In 1991, I worked in Toronto when I was still in the United Church at Fred Victor Mission, which is still the biggest United Church mission. And I found there was drug dealing, money laundering going on in the staff. That was proven by people on the staff. The RCMP wouldn't refuse because wouldn't investigate. They refused to investigate because
right.
it was the church. But, you know, one of the things that was clear from that was that there was this kind of understanding between the government and the church that they could do anything they wanted and they would not be held liable. Well, why do you think that there's not one person who's ever gone to jail for the death of a child in a residential school when 50,000 or more of them died?
Right? Yeah. Yeah, the government version of what you're talking about is CPS. Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services are just another extension of this or the crimes that are being committed against immigrant children and all children. I mean, they're killing them like outright, and they're putting them in, taking them away from for mothers and families that are fully capable of looking after them, and giving them the families that have a record of child abuse. This has been...
Well, the thing to understand is that it's the child trafficking networks in Canada operate primarily within the government system itself and social services. There's a former social worker, Rob Nicholson, who wrote a book called Stolen Innocence.
Ah, yes.
In 1995.
Yeah.
And he showed how known pedophiles... Now, that's a word I don't even like to use either, because in Greek it means friend of children. And this is a deliberately used word to confuse us as to what's going on. The child rapists, let's just call it for what it is, child traffickers, child rapists, they operate right within the government system. So there's a network of police, social workers, judges, who are all in the network, and the others don't rat on them at all. And I learned this working on the streets of Vancouver 20, 25 years ago, too. You know who the dirty cops are, and the other cops just look the other way, right?
Right.
In the case of judges, it's even more blatant than protecting one another, protecting child rapists. Two Supreme Court judges were named as being members of the Vancouver Club who were bringing children in. We even had them on film doing that. And the lawyer who tried suing them got put in a psych institution. His name is Jack Cramp, back in 1994.
Really?
So, yeah, that's a notorious case of breaking the child trafficking ring, trying to. The Vancouver province was going to do a series of articles on it. It was shut down by lawyers for these judges. It goes on and on like that. But Rob Nicholson's point is that you can't detect the child trafficking now. Occasionally they'll throw somebody to the wolf so the media can feed on them. And like the guy in Penn State University, everyone gets angry at him for 3 minutes, not realizing there's a whole system at work.
Of course. Right?
Yeah. How does 100,000 children go missing every year in North America?
There you
Unless
go.
Unless it's done systematically.
Well, what about the... This is sort of a left-field question, so I'm known for that. But what about the occult influences, the occult practices and the ritual? We've had guests on our show talking about some of the ritual stuff connected to the Catholic Church as well. And secret societies and, you know, the story.
Well, it's interesting you say that because one of the people I worked with on Vancouver Island, she wrote a book called Michelle Remembers. And it's her story of as a little girl in Victoria. And Victoria was named as one of the major satanic ritual centers in the world. Mm-hmm. Geneva, Victoria, B.C.
Yeah. Victor, Victoria. Victor stands for Lucifer.
Right. Okay,
Victor, well, Lucifer.
But Michelle, as a little boy, or as a little girl... was brought in, she was raised in, there's whole covens of satanic families, and they have women as breeders who have babies so they can be sacrificed, because child sacrifice is part of the whole ritual of living off the energy, the blood of the innocent.
Right, right.
Now, that is an implicit idea in Catholic Christianity, too, you know, the saving power of the blood of the innocent. So it's tied in very much with that theology.
Right.
But, and that children are all born sinful, all of that nonsense, right? But, what in this case, she was raised in this family. She was used sexually from like age one on. She watched other children get murdered, and she went into deep analysis about it. She wrote a book about it. Her psychiatrist, who was documenting all, died of a heart attack when he was bringing out a report of what had happened to her. But what she said is the main place this happened was in the basement of a Catholic church in Saanich, British Columbia. That's just north of Victoria. And, you know, I've had a lot of experiences of, okay, I'll tell you, right, my first day, my first presbytery meeting, that's Comox and Nanaimo Presbytery, it's the regional gathering of clergy on Vancouver Island.
Okay.
It's like where the ministers get together 3 or 4 times a year to discuss church business and all that. Well, at the very first presbytery meeting, I was the youngest minister there, the new guy on the block, I was 38. This older guy comes over to me and he starts talking. His name is Oliver Howard. He was my predecessor at St. Andrew's United Church. And he used to be a missionary on this mission boat that went up and down the coast of the Indian villages, right?
Uh-huh.
He was tied in with all of these guys who had done crimes, it turned out subsequently, including Dr. George Darby, who would go around sterilizing Native women at this hospital whose records we can't see anymore.
Right.
Anyway, Oliver Howard comes over to me during the presbytery meeting, sits down and we're chatting away, and then he looks at me very strangely and he says, well, you know, it's easy to get children around here. And I just was like a comment right out of left field. I said, what? I didn't know what he meant. He said, oh, you know, if people want children, it's easy to find them. And then I just looked at him really oddly, like, what are you doing? What are you suggesting? And then he kind of, it was a probe to see if I was interested.
It was a test. I was going to say, that's just a test. Yeah. He wanted to see if you were like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And if I had to say, not even in terms of me personally, but what my reaction was, he would then know if I was safe.
Right.
Somebody could, and the fact that I didn't look safe when I was questioning him said, okay, I'll go on a list of somebody not to trust.
Right.
It's like in that cop in movie Serpico, right?
His
line in the movie is, the honest cops can't be trusted, and they never are, because they might rat out the others.
Right.
Same, even more so in the church. They identified who, and they. I went on a list, and at that point, that's why I was taken out so quickly, because I was already on the radar screen.
You were already on that list.
But it shows you how deeply embedded that is. And another example of that is, well, I mentioned that Russell Crossley, the United Church minister, who got moved around and finally only did a few months in prison.
Right.
He was protected by the church. There's a camp counselor, Quamis, in Surrey, a United Church camp. A known child rapist was hired at this camp, and one of the camp workers notified the police about it. She gets fired. He doesn't.
Yep.
Finally, he's brought to trial and is convicted. But even after he's convicted, she's not rehired. Now, what does that tell you? If they're not going to acknowledge, it's because there's more people in the church doing it.
Well, she was being used as an example.
Right. And just like I was, mine was the only public defrocking of a minister in United Church history. It was a show trial to scare everybody off.
Right.
Because I was sitting on dynamite. And it goes on and on. I mean, just when I left Vancouver a few weeks ago, it turns out First United Church, which is the main church on kind of the downtown Skid Row area, a woman said that they church workers at night, there's a drop-in center for homeless to sleep in the church. They'd been raping women in the church for like a year, and nobody reported them because they'd been hired by the minister. This was another known offender.
Right.
This goes on openly. They can hire known rapists, and they cause this crime, and they get away with it, and they never even... So it's proof that the church can do whatever they like. They're a law unto themselves.
Law unto themselves.
Yeah.
And the connections with the occult and the rituals, and like you said, you were aware of that and 25 years ago, but not to the depth.
No,
that you're aware now.
Peeling back the onion skin. Like the rabbit hole keeps going a lot deeper, right? It keeps getting
messier. There's probably a lot more to it.
Oh, there is. We just scratched the surface so far. But over here, like for example in Brantford on these grounds, every day we're hearing more of these horror stories. People literally walking in the door here and saying, oh yeah, I saw a kid killed, now I can talk about it now. They often say, oh, we've been waiting our whole life for somebody like you to come along and to say, because we can't do it as Indians. We're too, basically, they're too, in many cases, just too traumatized from this,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think that's why the system feared me so much for so long. It still does, because I had credibility, educated guy, you know, minister, people listen to me.
Right,
so
right.
All they can do is just discredit and circulate rumors and lies about me, and so people won't talk to me. And that's, short of killing somebody, that's how you kill their
reputation. Yeah, but the people that do talk to you have these stories,
yep.
which give you more information.
Yep.
We were talking earlier about, since your film is 4 years old, you're considering doing an updated version because there's so many more gaps that can be filled at this point, and so much more information has come out. And when are you thinking of doing that, or is it sort of I really should get on that sort of thing?
No, it's in the works as we're talking.
Okay.
But this film is going to be looking at child trafficking today. It's going to be looking at how it's impacting. We're going to be naming the names. It's a lot more, in a way, more dangerous than the previous one. So
okay.
We have to be more careful, need more security. And we
and the first one was pretty darn dangerous.
Well, we operate with little or no money, so
right.
We can all rely on people in the community to help us. That's what takes longer.
Right. And hopefully a bunch of people will order your book and help support you that way. I'll have a link, like I said, on the site. I urge anybody to get that book because that helps, you know, pay your bills because, this is what you do now. This is your life.
This has been my purpose for 15 years.
Yeah. Traveling around, finding out more information, talking to people, consoling people, understanding, doing the preacher's job without the
church.
Without the church.
Which feels pretty good, actually.
Which is really sort of an organic way of doing it,
yeah.
isn't it?
Well, it's supposed to be that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's not supposed to be a big institution with a lot of money and genocidal agendas, right?
Yeah, I heard one of our previous guests say once, the religion as an institution is the last refuge of the human ego.
Sure enough.
And, you know, so that's very interesting.
What would it take for an individual to be able to bring charges against somebody?
In Canada, there's nothing you can do about this. Canadian courts will refuse to act on it, as they've done for years. There's two alternatives. International route, trying to get this hearing in, you know, international court, some justice. There is a thing called now called the International Criminal Court, which has jurisdiction to hear these cases of genocide against heads of state.
No, but I'm saying like churches. If an individual who, let's say, got raped, right,
yep,
and knows the perpetrator, could they not bring him to justice in any way?
You mean just being raped?
Yeah,
let's say there was one of the people that were in the institution who know that the preacher raped them.
You can always bring charges against somebody who rapes you. The conviction rate is very low. Canada's one of the lowest conviction rates in the world for that, especially if it's a child. Stephen Harper just changed the criminal code, making it more of an offense under the law to own a pot plant than to rape a child.
Yeah.
Minimal sentence 1 year for child rape in Canada. It's the lowest in the world. So your chances are slim to none about getting justice through the courts in Canada. If you're an Indian, there is no chance because it's already been wrapped up in an agreement whereby the churches can never be prosecuted for any of these crimes. So the international route, Native people are setting up their own courts under common law, under their own landlord jurisdiction, saying, you know, well, we're going to try our own kind of justice because the crown justice doesn't work, right?
Right.
People on the West Coast are beginning to do that in the Squamish Nation.
Okay.
Some of the Anishinaabe in Manitoba. And we've suggested here to the Mohawks. And they have that own tradition in the Longhouse anyway of doing, having their own authorities. So I'm hoping that'll spread.
And the Council of... somebody once said, if we let our nation with a council of grandmothers, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing?
Well, traditionally, that's the way it was in many countries, including our European ancestors had that as well. Matrilineal societies.
Yeah.
Common law came out of that tradition.
It's true.
You know, that's the roots of common law is in Saxon tribal law that said the law shall harm no one. It exists to protect the community. It's not the result of a sovereign telling you what your rights are and removing them when they like it.
Right.
The Roman notion, canon law,
right,
you know, Napoleonic code and all that. Common law is a very radical thing and a very good thing if people practice it, but they don't know it exists because we've never been taught it.
And they're so caught up in admiralty law that they don't realize that they have innate rights. You know, do no harm to others, have no harm done to you. You know, it's really simple when you boil it down. We had Rob of the Paget family there. He had built his own home, an earthship, fully off the grid, raises organic, he has an organic farm, organic chickens, you know, no chemicals, all the good stuff. Stuff that the Indians knew a long time ago, and if we would have, you know, did more learning from them instead of the other way around, brainwashing them, if we would have learned from them, maybe we'd be living healthier right now. You know? What's your opinion on that?
We have to go back to that, otherwise we don't have a future. And I don't mean just copying Native people, but going back to our own kind of inherent knowledge and the things that you know, at a young age, they try to drive out of us.
Right.
Well, they say, ultimately, what's this story about? It's really about discovering that for any society like ours to function, it needs to traumatize children at a young age in order to make them part of a hierarchical, kind of corporatized, dehumanized society.
You have to beat that individuality,
right,
individuality and humanity out of them.
And that's inherent in European child-rearing methods, where it was believed the child was willful, had to be battered into submission to authority. I remember the quote from, there was the guy who ran the death camp at Auschwitz, Haas his name was. He said, he wasn't psychotic, he wasn't a criminal in his own mind, he was just a law-abiding German citizen. And he said, at a young age, he was taught that the most important value was obedience to authority. And he had moral qualms, actually. It was very interesting to read before they hanged him. He wrote a whole kind of account, personal account. And he was actually quite a humanitarian guy. But he sat there and he allowed these people to be murdered in this death camp, just like the principal here and the teacher stood by and let these kids killed, thinking they were okay individual, but knowing that there's a higher
mm-hmm.
allegiance he had, and that was to the authority. Even if the authority was saying kill children, kill
even humans, if the authority was wrong.
Even if it's wrong, you're supposed to suspend your own moral judgment. That can only happen if that's been battered out of you at a young age. So this is hitting on a very fundamental issue. It's just elites rule through the destruction of natural childhood innocence and autonomy and the wisdom of childhood. Like in indigenous cultures, you don't harm children because you learn from them.
Right.
You learn about the natural order. They instruct, you allow them to grow up naturally like a tree, right? And instead of being pruned every 3 seconds, you know, by which is what happens in our culture, right? And so that's a deeper lesson for all of this work that, you know, I think this is what the threat represented by my work is that we're saying, well, if that, we shouldn't allow that to happen to any child, you're challenging the whole hierarchical basis of their power and control.
It comes out to, it sort of comes out to the excuse, I was just following orders.
Which is not an excuse under international law anymore. You can't make that defense anymore.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, yeah. Well, there's a thing in 1950 called the Nuremberg legal precedents. And, you know, of course, the Western powers are all hypocritical because they were doing all the same crimes at the same time.
Yeah.
But in this case, at least you take the principle, and it says if your government is engaged in war crimes or crimes of aggression, like Canada is in Afghanistan, like America is in Iraq, you have an obligation not to pay taxes because you're colluding in crimes against humanity.
Right.
And the Germans, after World War II, were not tried for genocide. Genocide was never put on trial at Nuremberg. They were tried for planning and conducting a war of aggression against non-belligerent nations. Well, that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So under the Nuremberg laws, we'd be up on the witness stand, but winners are the ones who write the
rules. It's the cognitive dissidence, really. They charge the Germans, but then drop napalm on entire villages. You know, cognitive dissidence.
Yeah, like our atrocities are more moral than theirs. I mean, it doesn't work that way.
I think back in the ancient times, the excuse was, well, God's on our side, and we're supposed to kill you heathens. So it's okay.
The Jews are doing it to the Palestinians as they've been.
Yeah, the examples all over the world.
It's examples like all
that sickness in us that unless you address this stuff, it's going to just keep continuing. And that's, I guess, one of the other purposes I found in life is to draw those connections to show that we're the ones who are sick. We're the ones who need the healing folks, not the Aboriginal people. Right?
And we're unsane. Yeah. We're not insane. Yeah. We're unsane, as Michael Tesserian says.
Right.
And we've had him on the show, and he talks a lot about this sort of psychology behind the pathology, the psychotic thought processes that go on to justify the acts and the cognitive dissonance that goes on, and how we can justify actions and talk about other actions as being bad and evil when our own actions are reflective of those same actions. But you can use this word spell power magic to change the meaning of things.
Yeah. You know, but everybody tries to justify their own way.
That's true.
Whatever is beneficial to them. Right?
But this is a mass. You know, these are mass skills.
But a lot of it is us.
Humans. I agree.
You know, we try to justify, you know, whatever action, wrong or right, that we do. You know, and if it doesn't, might not fit you.
right.
I feel it was okay, so hey, do I do it? You know, and when you get into larger groups that are controlling situations, then, you know, it just becomes more exacerbated.
Yeah, it just becomes more extreme, doesn't
extreme,
it?
Extreme, yeah.
Extreme.
And that's been going on for probably, you know, hundreds of years, if not longer. So,
so what is upcoming? What are your upcoming? It's, what's the date today?
Today is
21st of November tomorrow.
21st of November. And so what do you got coming up for the rest of the winter and next year? What big events do you have coming up?
Well, there's the work we're doing here is really important because it's involving the first time the mass graves are being opened in Canada.
Oh, right, yeah.
We need, by the new year, this information compiled in a report that we're going to take over to Europe. Excuse me. Events related to that are really significant because we've got groups coming from all over Europe to look at this evidence, to converge on Rome on Easter Sunday and April 8th, and we're kind of building everybody towards doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a first of its kind.
And that, like you said, is a cooperative effort?
Yeah, groups in Ireland, England, Germany, Italy, Australia, America, Canada. I mean, they're all, this is igniting people everywhere. I mean, everywhere I go, in the last year, I've probably spoken in 50 to 100 cities all over the world.
Wow.
And smaller communities. And I've seen so many indications that the human race is really waking up now.
You've seen that.
Everywhere I go, you see the same thing.
So you like, we're not just talking about a hypothetical thing.
No, I see it.
You're
all the time.
Literally seeing this.
I'm seeing that if you know, it's like if you stay in the bubble world created mm-hmm. by the media, and that you think things are pretty bad. When you get outside that and you just look at people on the ground, very, very few people support the system anymore. They just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
They don't see an alternative.
I think that's the problem.
But not having an alternative is not the same as a
right, right.
If it was up to each individual, I'd say 90% of the people would walk away right now from the system, but they've got to see an alternative before.
Right.
Most people are like that. They're not going to do anything if they think there's no chance of it working.
Right.
It's very few of us who actually are willing to go out on a limb all the time and have a snap and get up and keep going and, you know, have a vision of another world and keep fighting. And we have a responsibility to keep doing that for the others. But people are yearning for that now.
Well, I think
that's what the occupation movement is
all about. I think that's all about. I agree 100%. What you're providing is just another gear, you know what I mean? Because what people need is, even in our individual lives, when we don't make a decision like that. We make a decision because a lot of little things lead us to that decision before we finally take a step to do something. All of what I've said before about the Occupy movement is the Occupy movement isn't a new thing. It's a cyclical event. You see it in the fall of cultures all through time. You've seen it in the French Revolution. You've seen it in the 60s when they had that, and that got co-opted, and you know. And I think this one's just too big to co-opt.
Yeah.
It's in 4,000 cities worldwide right now. And it's a huge wave. It's like a tsunami. It's like 60s times 1,000 because of our interconnectedness now. If we would have had the internet back in the 60s, this would be all over.
Yeah, and I saw a really neat picture. It's on one of those historic photos you see. And it was in San Francisco where there was 100,000 people in the streets and they shut down the waterfront for a while. And they were beginning to affect the economy, so the big boys are getting worried about that, right? So What was interesting about this picture, it showed a young man and woman, they were like 18, 19, you know, and they're the ones who tend to make revolutions,
right.
People at that age. And they were talking to these riot police, and they had such innocence and love and truth just looking into the eyes of these guys. And each one of these guys was like this firm mask behind the riot shield.
Yeah.
But one of them you saw had broken a little bit, and he was looking at them with interest. That's what happens if you read accounts of revolutions. When the army and the police start going over, happened in Egypt most recently, right?
Right.
That's when the power of the state collapses because they don't have it anymore. And that began to happen. That's why they had to pull out of Vietnam. The army had collapsed.
Yeah.
And when you make the moral appeal to the heart, they have no defense against that. That's why they have to incite violence so that people get out of their hearts and they have a way to justify the violence and repress and stop
that. I think that's the way they're trying to stop them right now, too.
They always do it. You can predict what they're going to do. Any veteran of any of this movement knows exactly what they're going to do, and they can recognize, see it coming. But the younger people don't have that experience, and it's hard to just go and teach them because they have to learn it for themselves. But then in so doing, there's a lot of defeats.
Yeah.
And
right.
The defeats tend to demoralize people, isolate them back into our little lives again. So we have to find some way of sharing those lessons to say, okay, here's exactly the plan.
Yeah.
And they may vary a little bit, but the aim is to divide and conquer like they did with the Native people here, and they're still doing through their band councils and everything. Divide and conquer by offering some of your reforms and ice saying, you, those guys are crazy, don't associate with them,
right.
Which is what they try on me all the time, about me.
Right.
You know, the various lies they put out there. But the important thing is remembering that picture. It's the way to bring the system out of the heart.
I agree.
Well, I tend to think right now that the Occupy movement, and I said it, you know, even a couple of years ago that this was going to come.
This is coming, yeah.
Because I think part of the idea was, and this is, you know, I don't know whatever conspiracy theory that you want to talk about, you know, in the U.S. that we're building like these camps. You know,
the FEMA camps.
Eventually, you know, they can fit a lot of folks, and you know, what would be the reason they want to build more jails? Now they want to do all this kind of thing.
Well, I think that's part of
the G20 was a perfect example
of
how
you know, they try to manipulate the situation and not allow the type of things that people, you know, were talking about. Yeah. And it shows that our so-called democracy is not really a democracy. It's just, you know, up to what limits they allow you to be.
Democracy is two wolves and a sheep fighting over,
you know,
what's
for dinner. So now I think people are starting to get that little whiff, you know, that maybe there's a little bit more to it. So now they're testing the waters. I think, I don't think the Occupy movement still has a defined goal as yet, right? But it's testing the waters to see what, you know, the response.
Well, consciousness doesn't have a defined goal. And I think the Occupy movement is reflective of that.
It's alive, therefore it's growing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not an organization, it's an organism, if you like.
It's an organism.
It's an organism. I agree.
And the thing is, sooner or later, I've been saying that, sooner or later, somebody's going to make a big mistake, right? By, you know, arresting or doing, you know, some killing or something is going to happen somewhere along the line, which is going to create a bigger wave.
Yeah, and then the water will come over, you know, the edge of the pail, and that'll be it. And then the water still.
And I think now they're starting to work because the politicians are, you know, I mean, here they supposedly they're concerned about a park that you know is being torn apart and it's going to cost
Zuccotti.
A whole bunch of money. Yeah. You know?
But they went in there to clean it up. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, but that I think that's just a, you know, a sidebar to try to confuse people.
Well, I think part of what you're doing is because I feel that everything's connected. All of these things that are connected. And when you said that you witnessed one-on-one that the people are actually waking up, you're not just imagining that, you're not just hoping that would be the case. You're literally seeing that more and more people are waking up to these things.
Yep.
And maybe it is the time for that. So when you do this thing in April, I think you're going to, I mean, I can't predict the future, but it's possible that you'll have even more of an effect than you had the last two times.
I think it will, because each time we've done it, we've gotten more support on the ground.
Well, even more so, the fact that this whole thing started as a Native Canadian thing, and now it's becoming a worldwide thing.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny, too, wherever I go, people know about me. It doesn't matter what city you attend, Copenhagen, I was in Slovenia, you know, up in the mountains of former Yugoslavia, a little village, and they heard about me.
Yeah.
Literally. It was a small town.
Yeah.
It wasn't a village exactly, it was 10,000 people, but, Kevin, I know, a lot of them speak English over there, but,
yeah
they know about, and the miracle of the internet, if you want to call
it.
Yeah, it's just, it's amazing to walk into that situation. So I remember back in the 60s, people learned things a lot slower because it was leaflets and telephones.
Well, it was, yeah.
Now it's like,
instant knowledge.
And I think what was happening in the Arab countries, I think fueled all these movements. And now I think, you know, as they grow, a lot of these institutions and governments are going to become very, very worried.
2012 is going to be a very interesting year.
You know, I was saying that I thought from those, when they talk about 2012 being a new consciousness and all this kind of stuff, that was the new consciousness.
Yeah, that's it.
What's going to happen in 2012 is going to be an anarchy, not consciousness in the sense of, you know, waking up and, making
anarchy.
Some...
But waking up is part of it.
No, but I mean, you know, people think it's
all the word,
you know,
anarchy means, anarchos means no authority.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean violence and it doesn't mean bombing. And that's what they did to brainwash people. All it means is you don't have an authority over you. You're self-governing.
Exactly.
Self-governance.
People are self
conscious self-governance.
You don't need government. You don't need authority. You don't police your jails. You manage just like indigenous people do traditionally.
Mm-hmm. You don't need to be ruled. You don't need to ask permission.
No.
We're all grown-ups now.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the thing, right? If you think back in like I said, indigenous people and you know, back, in other cultures, you know, what kind of, did they ever have jails? I don't recall that.
No, there were
during
jails
in history.
They called it, it's a fancy term in anthropology, distributive rather than retributive justice. So in a community, and I know people on the coast were telling me this among the Cowichans, if somebody did a crime, they were banished from the community.
Yeah.
They were ostracized. And in a close-knit system like that, that's like death.
That's like death, yeah.
But you know, they also had a way of protecting children. If anybody harmed a child, there was a group among the Cowichan people, a group of men security, like the Men's Fire group here in Mohawk.
Okay.
They'd take the offender out in the woods and you'd never see them again.
Yeah.
Because, and I said, oh, they killed him? He said, well, the life of an individual is as important as the life of a child, because they're our future. They knew that if we allow that to happen to our children, we don't have a future.
Exactly. Right.
So that's no toleration, just...
No toleration.
Child abuse, as opposed to 1 year sentence, and then you're out again to do it again.
Or a couple months.
Exactly, yeah. What does it tell you?
And a big pension plan. A couple months jail, big pension plan.
It's a reward.
Yeah.
For farming children.
Yeah. Unbelievable. So we're upside down.
We are.
We are sort of, the whole system is upside down. And maybe that's part of the problem. Maybe that's what people are, what we're talking about is people are waking up to, is everything is upside down.
There's that expression, the world turned upside down, which is what happens in any real spiritual revolution. You turn things on their head.
Right.
And that's what we're talking about.
You know, when a law comes into effect, right, do we make those decisions or the politicians make? But because we chose those politicians, right? We give them the right to do whatever. But
can't do
they're part of a system.
Yeah, we chose the choice of what, 2, 3?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but they are part of the system. That's the funny thing that people do not understand.
So we withdraw that. Just withdraw the allegiance to the system. Stop electing them. Stop paying their taxes. Be self-governing and they'll fall.
Exactly.
Stop paying them.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll go.
Saying, you don't represent me.
Get a real job.
Nobody can represent me.
No, you're grown up. You're a big boy.
I take responsibility. So
you can look after yourself.
That's what we got to show people. Like anyone can do that.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, obviously that fella did.
Okay.
He managed to do.
Well, I'd like to thank you.
Thank you both.
I'd like to thank you. Very interesting conversation.
Yeah.
We went off into some unusual areas, but you know what? That's just part of the consciousness.
Yeah, that's right.
We need to go into all these areas because they are all connected.
Yeah.
It's a wheel, and these are just spokes.
Mm-hmm.
The hub is what's important.
Right. Well, I'll keep you updated.
I want to. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I have a new section on our website. We're going to be putting. Just tell us your two websites.
ITCCS.org.
Okay.
HiddenNoLonger.com is the book.
Okay.
And HiddenFromHistory.org. There's three actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And people can order your book on the on that.
Yep.
The website.
HiddenFromHistory.org.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.